Yuri stayed. The envoys took cup in hand and each poured the sacred drops. Then Odysseus led the way back. Patroclus gave orders to the servants to lay a bed for Phoenix without delay, and they made him a comfortable pile of fleeces and rugs with sheets of fine linen. There the old man slept. But Achilles slept in the hut, and beside him the rosy-cheeked Diomede, a daughter of Phorbas, whom he had brought from Lesbos. Patroclus lay opposite, and he also had his companion, Iphis, whom Achilles gave him after the capture of Scyros. When the envoys reached Agamemnon's quarters, all present rose to their feet, and holding up their cups of gold, pledged them, standing each in his place. Then they asked what had happened. Agamemnon began, "Do tell me now, Odysseus, we are most grateful to you, sir. Is he willing to defend our ships from the fire, or does he refuse? Is he still in the same proud temper?" Odysseus answered, "May it please your grace, my lord King Agamemnon, the man will not quench his anger. He is even more full of passion, and rejects you and your gifts. He bids you consider for yourself with your people how you may save the ships and the nation. He threatens to launch his own ships with tomorrow's dawn. He advises us all to sail home, since you will never see the end of Troy City, for Zeus has lifted a protecting hand over it and given courage to the people. That is his message. And here are those to tell you the same who were with me there, Aeus and the two excellent heralds. But old Phoenix has stayed behind for the night. Achilles told him to stay, that he might go away with him tomorrow if he likes, but there shall be no compulsion." All heard this, aghast, in dead silence. It was a heavy blow. They were long silent, but at last Diomedes broke the silence, as usual.
"May it please your grace, my lord King Agamemnon, it was a great pity to ask Pelion at all, or to offer you heaps of treasure. He is always a proud man, and now you have made him prouder than ever. Very well. Let us leave him to stay or go as he likes. He shall appear in battle once more whenever he feels inclined, or when God makes him go. Now then, this is my advice. Let us all have a good meal and a good sleep. Sound sleep and wine and food make the heart and muscles good, you know. And when the dark no longer lingers, but dawn puts out her rosy fingers, marshal your men and horses betimes, and lead them yourself in the van."
This pleased them, and all applauded heartily. So they dispersed to their quarters and enjoyed the boon of sleep. Book 10. How Diomedes and Odysseus went on a night raid, and how they fared. The other chiefs and princes slept soundly all the night long, but not Agamemnon. No sleep visited his eyes. The lord and commander of that great host had too much to make him anxious. He groaned again and again from the bottom of his heart, and his spirit trembled within him. There was storm in his mind, as when Zeus' thunderer flashes the lightning and sends torrents of rain or hail, or covers the fields with snow, or when he opens the mouth of ravening war. So we may imagine the king puffing and groaning as thick as hail when he looked out over the plain. He was amazed at the countless fires of the Trojan bivouac, the piping and the trumpeting and the stir and bustle of men. But when he turned to his own people and the ships, he tore the hair from his head and groaned, praying to Zeus on high. The best thing he could think of was to seek out Nestor and Eliades and see whether they could contrive some plan between them to defend their people from destruction. So he sat up and put on tunic and boots and threw over all a tawny lionskin that reached to his feet. Lastly, he took spear in hand. Also Menelaus was too anxious to get a wink of sleep. He too feared what might happen to the Danians, since he was himself the cause of their long voyage over the sea and the long struggle of the war. He threw a dappled leopard skin over his shoulders and set a bronze helmet upon his head and seized a spear. Then he went out to wake his brother the king. He found him beside his vessel, just putting on his armor, and glad indeed was Agamemnon to see him. Menelaus said, "Why are you arming, my dear fellow? Do you think of sending out a spy? I'm dreadfully afraid you will not find a man ready for that job, to go out all alone in the depth of night and spy in the enemy camp, he will be a plucky man. Agamemnon answered, We must find some plan, you and I, my dear Menelaus, something useful to save our people and our ships, now Zeus has changed his mind. Hector's offerings, as it seems, are more to his mind than ours. For I never saw or heard in my life that one man in one day did so much mischief as Hector has done against us, just by himself. He's no son of a god or goddess, but he has done things that our nation will lament for ever and ever. What a mess he has made. Come along, run as fast as you can, and call Aias and Idomeneus. I will look up Nestor and see if he will come with us to the young fellows on outpost duty, and tell them what to do. They will listen to him more than anyone, for his son is in command of the outposts. He and Meriones, the friend of Idomeneus, we put them in general charge. Menelaus said, Then what do you want me to do? Shall I stay there with them and wait for you, or shall I call them first and then come back to you? Agamemnon answered, Stay with them, and then we shall not find amiss of each other. There are so many pathways in this camp. Call out wherever you go and tell them to get up, but address them with proper politeness, name and surname for each, and don't be too proud. We must do the work of menials ourselves. Such indignity was ordained for us, it seems, by Zeus on the day we were born. So his brother departed on his mission. Agamemnon himself made his way to old King Nestor. He found him beside his ship on a soft bed in his hut. Beside him lay his armor, shield and helmet, and a couple of spears, and there was the fine girdle which the old man used to wear when he led his people to battle, for he never thought himself too old. He lifted his head and raised himself on his elbow, calling out, "Who is this who comes along through the dark night when all others are sleeping in our camp? Someone hunting for his mules or hunting for his friends? Speak out. Speak or don't come near me. What do you want?" Agamemnon answered, "May it please your grace, my lord Nestor Neleides, you will know Agamemnon Atrides, one whom Zeus has plunged in trouble everlasting beyond all men, as long as the breath remains in my body and my knees can move. I wander here because I can't get a wink of sleep. I am so concerned for the war and the dangers of our people. I am terribly afraid about them. I am all a dodder. My heart will not keep still. It fairly jumps out of my body. My limbs are all of a tremble. If you fare to do something now that you are awake too, come with me to the outposts. Let us see if they have forgotten all about their watch, dead tired and fast asleep. Here's the enemy sitting close at hand, and we do not know whether they have a night attack in mind." Then Nestor said, "My lord, King Agamemnon, I am sure that Zeus all-wise will not accomplish all the purposes of Hector, as Hector now seems to expect. I think he will have troubles worse than ours if Achilles once changes his mind and forgets his resentment. I will go with you by all means. But let us wake up some of the others, Tydides with his spear, and Odysseus, and Aias, the one who can run, and Phylason, that stout fellow. Yes, there are others we might send someone for, big Aias and King Idomeneus, their ships are farther away, the others are near. But our dear friend, Menelaus, I have great respect for him, but I'll scold him as well, even if you don't like it, and I tell you so. Why is he asleep? Why has he left all this trouble to you? He might take a little trouble himself to go round calling people. We need it badly enough." Agamemnon said, "My dear lord, there are times when I will tell you myself to give him a scolding. He is often slack and will not take trouble, not because he grudges it, not because he is careless, but because he keeps his eye on me and waits till I begin. But this time he awoke long before me and came to me himself. Then I sent him to call the very men you mention. But let us go. We shall find them all outside with the watch where I directed them to meet." Nestor answered, "Then no one will blame him, and they will all do what he tells them." He put on tunic and boots, and taking a purple robe of fluffy wool, he folded it, spreading across, and buckled it over his shoulders. Then picking up a strong spear, he went out along the line of ships. First he wakened Odysseus with a loud call. Odysseus came out when he heard the cry and said, "What's the matter now? Why are you wandering about the camp in the darkness?" Nestor answered,
My lord Odysseus Laertiades, do not be angry when such dangers beset our people. Come with us, and let us wake someone else who may be able to advise us whether to fight or to retreat.
Odysseus at once went into his hut and threw a shield over his shoulders. He followed them to Diomedes, whom they found in the open air with his armor. The men of his company were sleeping round him, each with a shield for a pillow. Their spears stood upright with the butt spikes driven into the ground and the blades sparkling. You could see it a long way off like lightning in the sky. Diomedes was asleep upon an oxhide with a bright-colored rug under his head. Nestor stirred him up with his foot and said in reproachful tone,
"Get up, my dear man. Why do you sleep all night? Don't you know that the Trojans are close by, on the spring of the plain, with ever so little space between us?"
Diomedes was awake and up in a moment, and called out plainly,
"You're a hard one, old gentleman. You never rest. Are there no other men younger than you who might have gone the rounds to wake people up? There's no dealing with you, aged one."
Nestor answered,
"Quite true, my friend, quite right and proper. I have sons, and excellent boys they are. There are plenty of people who might go round with a summons. But we are all in very great danger. Fate stands now upon the razor's edge. Ruin and destruction for our nation, or life and breath. Come along, wake up Running Ears and Peleus' son. You are a younger man. Do have some pity on me."
Diomedes threw round his shoulders a tawny lion-skin that reached to his feet and grasped his spear. He went off at once and woke the two warriors and brought them along. When they all came to the outpost, they found the captains of the watch by no means asleep, but all wide awake and fully armed. There was no more sleep in their eyes than if they had been watchdogs in a sheepfold, when they hear some fierce wild beast moving through the hills and woods, and the noise of pursuing men and dogs. There was no sleep for them as they watched through that awful night. Their faces were turned to the plain while they listened for the coming enemy. The old man was pleased with what he saw and praised them.
"That's the way to watch, my dear boys. Don't let sleep get a grip of you, or we shall bring glee to our enemies."
With these words he crossed the moat, followed by the other captains who had been summoned to council. Meriones and Nestor's son went also by their invitation. They sat down in an open space which was free from dead bodies, the very place where Hector had turned when night came on. They talked for a while together, and then Nestor addressed them.
"My friends, I wonder if there is a man who can trust his own pluck enough to go among the enemy. He might get hold of some straggler, or he might hear some gossip and find out what is in their minds, whether they mean to stay out here near the ships, or to retire into the city now they have beaten us. He might find out all that and come back without a scratch. That would be a great credit to him. The world would ring with his praises, and he shall have a fine reward. Every prince in this fleet shall give him a black ewe with a suckling lamb, a priceless prize in all men's eyes. And he shall always be one at our dinners and feasts."
Nothing was said for a while, but then Diomedes spoke up.
"Nestor, I'm your man, ready and willing to visit the enemy camp. But if one more would go with me, that means more courage and more comfort. Two heads are better than one to see what ought to be done, and double the chance to win. One man alone may find, but one's but half a mind, and one man's wits are thin." Many wanted to go. Big Aeas was ready and running. Aeas was ready. Meriones was ready. Nestor's own son was more than ready. My lord King Menelaus was ready. Patient Odysseus, who loved a bold adventure, all were ready and eager to go scouting. Agamemnon said, "Diomedes, Tydides, you are a man after my own heart. Choose your comrade. Choose anyone you like, the best of these who offer. You see, there are plenty of them. Have no respect for persons. Don't leave the better man behind for respect of high birth or royal rank."
He said that because he was afraid for his brother Menelaus. Diomedes answered,
"If I may really choose my own comrade, how could I think of anyone but Prince Odysseus? The best man of all, ready heart and high temper in every enterprise, and beloved of Pallas Athena. If he goes with me, we should both come safe out of a burning fiery furnace, for he is the past master of stratagems."
Odysseus said to this,
Tydides, don't praise me too much. Everyone knows me for better or for worse. Let us go, then. Night is passing and dawn is near. See, the stars have moved onwards, and more than two parts of night are gone, so there is only one left.
Then both men armed themselves. Tydides had left his own sword behind, so Thrasymedes gave him one, and a shield. He put on a leather headpiece, without boss or plume, what the lads wear. They call it a skullcap. Meriones gave Odysseus bow and quiver and sword and a well-made headpiece of leather. This was stiffened inside with a strong web of leather laces and padded with felt, and outside rows of boar's tusks were fixed in a pattern. This fine piece was one of the thefts of Autolycus. He took it once in Ilion, after breaking into the house of Amintor Amenides, and gave it to Cytherean Amphidamas, who took it home to Scandia. Amphidamas gave it to Molus, his guest, and Molus gave it to his son Meriones to wear. Now it was fitted upon the head of Odysseus. So now then they were both well armed, and away they went. A good omen came to them as they set out. A heron on the right, Pallas Athena sent it. They could not see the bird in the darkness, but they heard it honking. Odysseus was glad at this and uttered a prayer to Athena. Hear me, O daughter of Zeus Almighty, thou who art ever by my side in all enterprises, thou who seest me wherever I move, now again be gracious to me, Athena. Grant that we may do some great thing to distress our enemies, and bring us back safe. Diomedes, after him, also made his prayer. Hear me also, daughter of Zeus, Atritone. Go with me as thou didst go with Tydeus, my father, to Thebes, when he was sent there as envoy of the Achaeans. He left them beside the Asopus and bore a friendly message to the Cadmeans, but on the way back he did doughty deeds with thy help, goddess divine, when thou didst stand by his side. So now let it please thee to stand by me and keep me safe. Then I will sacrifice to thee a yearling heifer, broad-browed, unbroken, which no man yet has brought under the yoke, and I will overlay the horns with gold. And Pallas Athena heard their prayers. Then they went on like a pair of lions through the black night, over carnage and over bodies, through arms and armor and red blood. Meanwhile, the Trojans were not asleep. Hector would not let them rest, but called an assembly of all the great men, the princes and leaders. Then he set his proposal before them. Who will do something for me? He said. He shall be well rewarded. I will give a car and a pair of horses, the best in the Achaean camp, to anyone who will dare. And it will make him famous, too. Anyone who will go close to the ships and find out whether the guards are carefully set as usual, or if they are quite beaten and meditating flight, if they are dead tired and can't keep guard. There was silence at this. But there was a man among them. The son of Eumedes, the herald, named Dolon, rich in gold, rich in bronze. He was a poor creature to look at, that is true, but a quick runner. He was an only son with five sisters. This man spoke up and said, Hector, I'm your man, ready and willing to visit the enemy ships and spy. Now then, lift up your staff and swear an oath to give me the fine chariot and horses which belong to Achilles Pelion, and I will be your spy. Not unsuccessful, not inglorious. I will go right through until I come to Agamemnon's vessel, where the great men are sure to be in council whether to fight or fly. Then Hector took up his staff and swore an oath.
Witness, Zeus himself, the thundering lord of Hera. No other man of Troy shall drive those horses, but they shall be your pride forever.
This oath was never kept, but it made Dolon go. Then and there he slung bow and arrows over his shoulders, and wrapped about him a grey wolfskin, put on a cap of polecat skin, took a sharp spear, and away he went towards the ships. But he was never to come back from those ships with news for Hector. When he got clear of the crowds of men and horses, he went on full of eagerness. Odysseus saw him coming, and said to his companion, "Someone there, Diomedes, coming from the camp. A spy, perhaps, or a man who wants to rob the dead, I don't know which. Let him pass by us a bit, and then we can jump on him and catch him quickly. If he is too fast for us, drive him in upon our ships, away from his camp. Charge him with your spear, and don't let him get back to the city." So they lay down among the dead bodies just off the path, and the man ran past quickly without seeing them. But when he had got as far away as the width of a day's work with mules, they are better than oxen to plough the deep fallow, the two ran after him, and he stood still, hearing a noise. He thought someone had come from the camp to fetch him back, and Hector wanted to retreat. But when they were a spear's throw distant or less, he knew them for enemies. Then he put on his best speed to escape, and they pursued at once like a couple of savage dogs on a hunt, chasing a fawn or a hare through the woods, while the creature runs whimpering before them. So Tydides and Odysseus cut him off from his people and chased him on and on until he nearly reached the watchman beside the ships. Then Athena gave strength to Tydides that he might come first, and no other man might have the credit of striking him down. Diomedes charged with ready spear and called out, "Stop, or I'll have you with this, and there will not be much chance for you then." As he spoke, he cast the spear, but he missed the fellow on purpose, and it passed over his right shoulder and stuck in the ground. The man stood still, staggering, his teeth chattering pale with fear. The others came up panting and seized both his arms. He burst into tears and cried, "Spare my life! I will pay ransom. There is bronze and gold and wrought iron at home. My father would be glad to give a rich ransom if he could hear that I am alive and your prisoner." Odysseus answered, "Don't be afraid. Don't worry about death. Just tell me and tell the truth. Where are you going like this, towards our ships and away from your camp, alone in the darkness of night when others are asleep? Do you want to strip the bodies of the dead? Or did Hector send you to spy out our doings? Or is it just a whim of your own?" Dolon answered, trembling in every limb, "A vain delusion, sir. Hector drove me out of my senses, promised to give me the horses of your illustrious Achilles and his magnificent chariot, told me to march through this black night into your camp and find out whether the guard was set over your ships as usual, or whether you were quite beaten and talking of flight and too tired to keep a proper watch." Odysseus said with a smile, "Upon my word, that was a great prize to covet, the horses of Achilles. They are not easy for a mortal man to drive, except Achilles himself, who had an immortal for his mother. Now, tell me this, and tell me the truth. Where did you leave Prince Hector? Where are his arms and armor? Where are his horses? How are the guard posts placed and the sleeping men? Tell me what their plans are. To stay out here before our ships, or to retire into the city now you have beaten your enemy?" Dolon answered, "Indeed, I will tell you the truth. Hector and his council are deliberating near the tomb of Ilos, away from the noise. As to the guard posts, sir, there is no special guard at all on watch in the camp. Wherever there is a fire, those who can't help it are awake and telling each other to watch. But our allies of many nations are asleep, for they leave watching to the Trojans. Their own wives and children are not within reach." Odysseus went on, "Well then, are they sleeping mixed up with the Trojans or apart? Tell me, I want to know all about it." Dolon answered, "Indeed, I will tell you that, sir. You can rely on me. Towards the sea, Acherians and Paeonian archers, and Lilesians and Caconians and Pelasgians. Towards Thymbra, the lot fell to Lycians and Mysians, Phrygians with horses and chariots, Maeonians with horses and chariots. But why do you ask me all this? If you wish to get into the Trojan lines, there are the Thracians far away at the very edge, newly come, and among them Rhesus, their king. His horses are the finest and tallest of all, whiter than snow, gold like the wind, and his chariot is adorned with gold and silver. Golden armor he has brought with him, prodigious, a wonder to behold, too good for a mortal man. But what about me? Take me in as your prisoner, or tie me up and leave me here, and then go and see whether I have told you the truth or not." At this, Diomedes said with a frowning face, "No escape for you, Dolon. Don't imagine such a thing. Now you are in our hands, although we are much obliged for your information.
If we set you free now and let you go, you will come another time to spy upon us or to fight. But if we kill you while we have you, then you will not trouble the Achaeans any more."
Dolan tried to put up his hand and caress his captor's chin and beg for mercy, but Diomedes gave him no time. He ran his sword through Dolan's neck and cut through both the sinews. Even while he spoke, his head rolled in the dust.
They pulled off his leather cap, wolfskin, bow, and spear, and Odysseus held them up high and gave thanks to Athena spoil-gatherer.
"Accept these, O goddess, with our thanks.
Thee first of all gods in Olympus will we invoke. Now send us on again to the Thracian horses and the place where the Thracians lie."
He lifted the spoils and hung them on a tamarisk. After that he grasped a handful of twigs and sprouts and tied them over as a sign to mark the place that they might not miss it in the darkness on the way back. Then they went on, picking their way through the relics of the fight and the pools of blood. Very soon they came upon the Thracians. They were in three ranks, all dead tired and asleep, and their gear was arranged in orderly fashion beside them. Near each man was his pair of horses. Rhesus slept in the middle, his horses tethered by the reins to the handrail of the car. Odysseus saw him first and pointed him out to Diomedes. "There's the man, Diomedes. There are the horses, just as Dolan told us before we killed him. Now then, pluck up your courage. You must not stand idle in your armor. Loose the horses, or you kill the men, and I'll look after the horses." Then Athena breathed strength into Diomedes. He struck right and left. There were ugly groans and cries as the sword went home, and the ground was reddened with blood. As a lion leaps furious on sheep or goats without a shepherd, so Tydides went up and down among the Thracians until he had killed 12. Odysseus went behind him, and every time he struck one of them, took hold of a foot and pulled him out of the way, so as to leave a clear space for the horses to pass without being scared by trampling on dead bodies, for they were not used to them yet. Lastly, Diomedes came to his 13th, the king, and killed him, panting and gasping. Diomedes was a nightmare for him by grace of Athena. Meanwhile, Odysseus loosed the horses and tied them together by the reins and drove them out of the crowd, beating them with his bow, for he had not thought to catch up the whip out of the car. Then he whistled to Diomedes. But Diomedes had paused to think what was the most audacious thing to do. Should he take the chariot with the fine armor in it and pull it out by the pole, or lift it off the wheels and carry, or should he kill some more Thracians? As he stood thinking, Athena was there and said to him, "Better go back now, or you may have to run for it, if some other god sends the Trojans to chase you home." He obeyed and quickly leapt on horseback. So did Odysseus, and beat both horses with his bow as they flew towards the ships. But Apollo Silverbow kept no blind man's watch. He saw Athena busy with Diomedes, and this provoked him. At once he plunged into the Trojan camp and woke Hippocoon, a kinsman of King Rhesus and a counselor among the Thracians. The man leapt up from sleep and saw the place empty where the horses had stood, and the men gasping and bleeding. He cried out and called his friend by name. Then there was a great disturbance and uproar, and people came running up wildly when they saw the devastation which the two men had made, and got off clear. When they reached the place where they had killed the spy, Odysseus checked the horses. Tydides jumped off and put the spoils in the other's hand, and got on again. He touched up the horses, and they were off like birds for the ships, as happy as could be. Nestor first heard them coming, and said, "My friends, my lords and captains, can I be wrong? Can it be true? Yes, I think so. Horses galloping is what I hear. I only hope it may be Odysseus and Diomedes driving from the Trojan camp, and so soon. But I am terribly afraid something may have happened to those fine fellows." Before he had well finished, they were there, the very men. No sooner were they down on their feet than the others gave them a hearty welcome and shook them by the hand, and Nestor said, "Do tell me about it, Odysseus. I can't praise you enough. This is a feather in your cap. How did you get those horses? Did you really get into the Trojan camp, or did some god meet you and make you a present? Like the shining sun, I do declare.
I am always about in the battle, and I don't bide in the rear, old as I am, but I have never set eyes on any horses like these. I suppose a god met you and gave them to you, for you are both well loved by Almighty Zeus Cloud-Gatherer and his daughter Athena Bright-Eyes.
Odysseus answered, Nestor Neleides, most illustrious king, it is easy for a god, if he will, to bestow even better horses than these, for the gods are almighty. But these horses, which you ask of, sir, are newly come. They are Thracians, and the Thracian king has been killed by Diomedes, and 12 of his best men by his side. Then for a 13th, we killed a scout near our lines, who had been sent to spy out the camp by Hector and his princes. Then, laughing aloud for joy, he drove the horses across the moat. They went on to Diomedes' quarters and tethered them in the stable with his other horses and gave them a feed of corn. Odysseus hung up the blood-stained spoils of Dolon on the stern of his own ship until he could prepare a sacrifice for Athena. Now he and Diomedes waded into the sea and washed off the sweat from shins and thighs and neck. Then, clean again and refreshed, they bathed in their stone tubs. So bathed and well rubbed with oil, they sat down to dine, and dipping their cups in a well-filled bowl of delicious wine, they poured the sacred grace for Athena.
Book 11. How the battle turned, and the captains were wounded, and Achilles began to take notice.
Now dawn arose from beside her lord Tithonus, to bring light for gods and men, and Zeus sent discord towards the Achaean ships, carrying in her dreadful hands a portent of war. She came to a stand beside the huge black hull of Odysseus' ship which lay in the middle, from which a voice could reach to Aeus Telamoniades and to Achilles at the two farthest ends. There she stood and uttered a loud and dreadful war cry, which put strength into the heart of every man in that host for battle and war unceasing. In a moment battle seemed to them sweeter than a happy voyage to their native land. Atrides shouted orders to arm, and he armed himself. First he buckled on his fine greaves with silver anklets. Next he donned the corselet, which Cinyras had given him as a guest gift, for the great rumor had come to Cyprus that the fleet was about to sail for Troy, and therefore he gave him this gift to please him. There were 10 stripes of dark blue enamel upon it, 12 of gold and 20 of tin. Blue dragons reached up towards the neck, 3 on each side, like the rainbow which Cronion sets in the cloud to be a portent for mortal men. Over his shoulders he threw the sword with shining knobs of solid gold and a silver sheath with golden slings. He caught up a brave shield of fine workmanship covering the body on both sides. 10 circles of bronze ran round it, and it had 20 bosses of white tin, with one of blue enamel in the middle. Upon this boss was the grim-faced Gorgon, glaring horribly, and on either side terror and panic. The shield strap was of silver, and a blue dragon was twining upon it, with 3 heads twisted together and growing from one neck. Upon his head he put a helmet with 2 horns and 4 bosses and a horsehair plume. How terrible was that nodding plume! He took a pair of sharp spears with blades of bronze, which sent their glittering gleam high into the air. Then Athena and Hera thundered in honor to the king of rich Mycenae. Now each man ordered his driver to keep back the horses in due order near the moat. The fighting men, fully armed, moved forward, and unquenchable rose the war cry to meet the morning. They were in place long before the chariots, which came and stood behind at a little distance. Then Cronides made a dreadful noise on them, and let fall a shower of bloody drops from the sky, since he was about to send to Hades many a mighty head. The Trojans were over against them on the rising of the plain, ranged about Hector, their great leader, and Polydamas the Immaculate, Aeneas, whom the people honored as more than man, and Antenor's 3 sons, Polybus and noble Agenor, and young Acamas, glorious heroes all. Hector was to be seen holding his round shield, now in front, now behind, giving his orders like a shining star of doom which flashes out of a cloud and then dives again into the darkness. The metal of his armor gleamed like the lightning of Zeus Almighty. The hosts were like 2 opposite lines of reapers driving their swaths in the wheat or barley of a great farm, while thick the handfuls fall. So Trojans and Achaeans leapt at each other, and neither side thought of giving way. Two equal ranks of heads, they were like raging wolves. Discord many moan was joyful at the sight. She alone was present out of all the gods. The others remained quietly in their own abodes on high Olympus. They all blamed Cronion Thundercloud because it seemed that he meant to give triumph to the Trojans. But the father cared nothing about them, as it seemed. He sat apart by himself in great satisfaction as he watched the Trojan city and the Achaean ships and the flashing arms, men slaying and men slain. So long as it was early and the day was growing, the volleys flew from both sides and the men fell. But at the time when a woodman's hands are weary with felling trees on the mountains, and he has had enough of it, when he begins to want a bite of sweet bread and gets ready his meal, at that time the Danians called a charge and broke the enemy ranks, shouting loudly to one another. Agamemnon was the first to charge his man and kill. He struck down Beinor, and after him his driver Oileus, who had jumped out of the car to face him. But as he came, the king drove his spear through helmet and forehead and spattered bone and brain inside. He stripped off the dead men's tunics and left them there with their skin shining white. Next he went after Isos and Antiphos, two of the sons of Priam, one bastard and one not, both together in one car. The bastard was driving, and Antiphos was his fighting mate. Achilles had once caught them both while keeping sheep on the foothills of Ida and tied them up with young withies, but he freed them for ransom. That time my lord Agamemnon struck Isos on the breast with his spear and knocked Antiphos out of the car with a sword stroke under the ear. Quickly he stripped off their armor, and then he knew them, for he had seen them in camp when Achilles brought them in. None of the Trojans could save them, but they were all driven away. They were helpless as a deer when a lion visits her lair and crunches up her young in his strong teeth. Their dam may be near, but she cannot help. She trembles herself in every limb and dashes away through the bushes and trees, all of a sweat in her haste to escape the mighty beast. Two others Agamemnon caught in one chariot, Pisandros and Hippolochus. Their father, Antimachus, was one who most strongly urged Alexandros not to surrender Helen to Menelaus. He expected gold from Alexandros. These two young men were both trying to hold the horses, but the reins slipped from their hands, and they were in confusion. Agamemnon leapt on them like a lion, and they cried for mercy. "Spare us, prince. You shall have a good ransom for us. There is plenty of treasure in the house of our father Antimachus, bronze and gold and wrought iron. He would gladly give any amount of it if he could hear that we are alive and your prisoners." But he answered their piteous words without pity. "If you are the sons of Antimachus..." He got up in public assembly and told them to kill Menelaus then and there when he had come on embassy with Odysseus to your city. Told them not to let him go now they had him. "Now then, you shall pay for your father's abominable outrage." With these words he struck Pisandros on the chest with his spear and tumbled him out on his back. Hippolochus jumped down, and Agamemnon killed him there on the ground, and cut off his hands and head, and sent the body trundling along like a roller. He left them both there, and leapt to the place where the throng was thickest. His men backed him up, and now they were killing the enemy in their headlong rout, horsemen against horsemen, footmen against footmen, while the thundering hooves of the horses drove up clouds of dust from the plain. Agamemnon slew and slew, shouting, "Come on! Come on!" How a devouring fire falls on a thick forest, how a wind carries it rolling along, how the trees fall, tearing out their roots as the flames blast them. So the Trojans in rout fell headlong before my lord King Agamemnon. So the rearing horses rattled the empty chariots behind with no ready master to guide them, for the masters lay dead on the ground. The vultures, darlings, now. Hector was out of reach, out of the dust, drawn away by the hand of Zeus from carnage and blood and tumult. But Atrides was after him, fiercely cheering on his men. The rushing rout went past the ancient tomb of Elos Dardanides, past the wild fig tree in the midst of the plain, making for the city. Atrides followed and followed, shouting aloud, his invincible hands bedabbled in gore. But when they were near the Scaean gates and the oak tree, both armies came to a stand, and faced each other. Some were still scattering over the plain like cattle scared into flight by some lion in the evening dusk. All but one who stares death in the face, for the lion catches her and breaks her neck with his strong teeth, then laps up the blood and guts. So followed Agamemnon Atrides, ever slaying the hindmost among the scattering herd. Many a man fell from his chariot under the hands of Atrides, face down or face up, as his mad spear drove on and on. Up to the city, up to the steep walls he would have pushed. But now the father of gods and men strode down from heaven and took his seat on Ida's peaks among the fountains, holding his thunderbolt. He called his messenger, Iris, and said, "Off with you, Iris, my quick one, and give this message to Hector. So long as he shall see Agamemnon full of fury, dealing death in the foremost of his host, let him command his army to fight and keep away himself. But as soon as he sees Agamemnon wounded by spear or arrow and mounting his car for retreat, I will give him power to kill until he drives them upon their ships, when the sun shall set and the darkness come." Swift as the wind, quick Iris did his bidding. She flew from the heights of Ida down to Ilios. There she found Hector standing in his car, and alighting beside him, she said, "Hector, most sapient prince, I have a message for you from Father Zeus. So long as you shall see Agamemnon full of fury, dealing death in the forefront of his host, command your army to fight, and keep away from the battle yourself. But as soon as you see him wounded by spear or arrow, and mounting his car for retreat, Zeus will give you power to kill until you drive them upon their ships when the sun shall set and the darkness come." Swiftly sped Iris away. Hector leapt from his chariot and rallied his men, shaking the spears in his hand as he showed himself here, there, and everywhere, urging all to fight. There was a dreadful conflict. They wheeled about and faced the Achaeans, who formed a strong front against them. There stood the two armies face to face. This was the turning point of the battle. Agamemnon, as ever, was in the front, and the first to stand against him was the redoubtable Iphidamas, Antenor's son. This man was bred and born in Thrace, the fat loam country, mother of sheep, as they call it. Boniface the Anno was his mother, and her father Sisyus brought him up from a little tot. But when he grew to the heyday of life, Sisyus married him to his daughter, and would have kept him there. But he, just wedded, went from his bridal chamber to follow the rumor of the great war with 12 ships. These he left in Pacote and came to Ilios by land. So that day he found himself face to face with Agamemnon. When they met, Agamemnon cast a spear first and missed. Iphidamas stabbed him under the corselet on the belt and put all his great weight into the blow. But the spear point did not go through. It was turned by the silver and bent like a lump of lead. Agamemnon seized the spear and pulled it with all his lion strength out of the man's hand. Then he struck the man's throat with his sword and killed him. So Iphidamas fell, and slept as in hoops of steel, unhappy man, fell fighting for his people, far from his bride so newly wed, of whom he had small comfort. And what a world of bridal gifts he had given, 100 cattle then and there, and 1,000 promised, goats and sheep also, all those countless flocks. But then Atrides Agamemnon stripped him of his fine armor and carried it away. Coon saw this, Coon, his eldest brother, and his eyes grew dim to see his brother fall, his own father's son. He stood where Agamemnon could not see, and stabbed him broadside on, piercing the arm just below the elbow, right through the flesh. Agamemnon shivered, but he did not stop. He leapt upon Coon with his wind-seasoned spear. At that moment, Coon was busy dragging away his brother's body by the foot and calling for help, but as he dragged him along, Agamemnon struck under the shield and killed him, then sheared off his head over the dead body. So two sons of Antenor there met their deaths and went down to the house of Hades. So long as the blood ran hot from the wound, Agamemnon was fighting everywhere with spear and sword and great stones. But when the blood ceased to flow and the wound began to dry, it became very painful. Cruel pains took hold upon him, piercing him through like a woman in labor, when the Eileithyi, Hera's daughters, deal out their bitter pangs. He mounted his car in agony and called out loudly, "My friends, my lords and captains,
I leave you to defend our ships and bear the brunt of the battle, for God, who knows best, would not let me see the day out with you."
Then he told the driver to make for the camp, for he was in great pain. The driver whipped up his team to a gallop, and away they flew in a cloud of dust, flecking their chests with foam, and carried their wounded king into safety. Hector saw the retreat of Agamemnon, and he shouted for all to hear, "Trojans, Lycians, Dardanians, fight the good fight! Be men, my friends! Strain every nerve! He's gone! Their best man is gone! Zeus has given the victory to me! Drive straight for the enemy! Strike them down and win!"
As a hunter hies on his hounds against a wild boar or lion, Prince Hector hied on his Trojans, and gave them new courage and new strength. Hector, Prince of Troy, like the god of war himself, ever in the front, ever falling on like a furious typhoon that lashes the lurid seas from above. Who first, who last, fell before the devastating onslaught of Hector Priamides when God gave him victory? Asius first, and Autonomous, and Opites, Dolops, Clytides, and Ophelcius, and Agelaus, Isimnos, and Oros, and brave Hipponous, these were the Danian captains whom he slew, and after them a multitude, like a tempest striking the crests of the waves, west wind buffeting the clouds of the white south wind, beating them off with a heavy squall, rolling up ranks of swollen waves, tearing the heads into flying foam, and scattering all abroad into the sky. So the heads of men fell in heaps before Hector. Now had been ruin utter and desperate, and the Achaeans had been routed and rolled back upon their ships, but for Odysseus. He called to Diomedes, "Tydides, what's the matter with you and me? Have we forgotten how to fight? Come here, you laggard, stand by me. It will be a shame indeed if Hector takes our ships." Diomedes answered, "Of course I'll stand and see it out, but we shan't do much good when Zeus Cloud-Gatherer means to let them beat us, as you can see." Then he knocked Thimbresis out of his chariot with one thrust of his spear, and Odysseus did the like for his driver, Melion. Having put these two out of the fight, the two men left them and ran wild among the throng, and dealt death around like a couple of wild boars at bay, venting their fury on a pack of hounds. Thus they gave a welcome breathing space to the Achaeans as they ran before Hector. Next they took a chariot and two men, Hippodamus and Hippyrochus, the best of their nation, the two sons of Percosian Merops. He was a great seer and diviner, and he had told his sons not to go to the war and risk their lives. But they would not listen, for the doom of death drove them on, and now they were robbed of life and breath by Diomedes, and Odysseus stripped them of their armor. Now Zeus Cronion stretched equal the cords of battle as he watched from Mount Ida, and the slaughter went on for both sides. Tydides wounded Agastrophus, Pyrrhus' son, on the hip joint. He went blundering about blindly through the crowd until he fell dead, for his man was not near with the horses to save him. But Hector saw this, and rushed on the two men, shouting at the head of the pursuing enemy. Diomedes shivered and called at once to his neighbor, "Our turn now! Here is ruin rolling upon us both, Hector himself! Hold your ground, let us stand and defend ourselves!" With the words he poised and threw his spear, and hit, no miss this time, aimed at the head, hit the top of the helmet. Metal glanced off metal, and did not go through the three layers of that visited morion, the gift of Phoebus Apollo, but the blow drove Hector far back into the crowd. He fell on his knees with one hand resting upon the ground, stunned and dizzy. Tydides saw where the spear ran into the ground some way off, and followed up. Meanwhile Hector came to, and found his car again, and got away with his life. But Diomedes recovered the spear and followed, crying out, "You have escaped once more, you cur. It was a nice thing that time, but Apollo saved you again. No doubt you remember your prayers before you go where spears are flying. I fancy I'll finish you off next time we meet, if I have a god or so to help me, too. For the moment, I will take anyone else I can find." Then he went on with the stripping of Agastrophus. He pulled the corselet from the man's body and the shield from his shoulders. But as he was taking off the helmet, Alexandros took aim at him from the tomb of Ilos Dardanides, where he stood with his bow and arrows behind the pillar. He drew bow and shot, and this shot did not miss Diomedes. It ran through the flat of his right foot as he knelt and pinned it to the ground. Then Alexandros came out of hiding and laughed aloud with glee as he cried, "A hit! This time it was no miss. I only wish it had gone into your belly and killed you. Then our people could have a little rest from their troubles, instead of shivering and bleating like a lot of goats before a lion."
Diomedes answered him quite composed, "Hide yourself and pull your bow. Come and steal a wife and go. Frizzle head with pretty curls. You can make eyes at pretty girls. Stand up and fight like a man, and much good will your bow and arrows be. This time you have just grazed my foot, and listen to the boasts. I care no more than if a woman shot me, or some fool of a boy. Blunt, I tell you, is the shot of a coward good for naught. Mine is quite another thing. One touch, and death is in the sting. Then the man's wife will have to tear her two cheeks, and his children will be orphans, while his blood reddens the earth and his body rots. More vultures than women about him, then."
As he spoke, Odysseus came and stood in front to protect him, while Diomedes sat down behind him and pulled the arrow through his foot with dreadful pain. Then he got into his car and told the driver to take him away to the ships. Now Odysseus was left quite alone. The others were too much afraid to stand by him, and he said within his unconquerable soul, "This is a bad business. What will become of me? If I show fear and run away from this mob, that is bad enough. But it is worse to be caught alone, as Cronion has put all the rest into a panic. But what's the use of such arguments? I know only cowards vanish out of the battle. But a brave man must stand his ground and either kill or be killed." While he was deliberating, the Trojans came up in great numbers and crowded all round him. But they had placed their own destruction in their midst. They harried him from all sides like a pack of hounds and huntsmen harrying a wild boar from the forest. He comes out of the deep thicket, wetting the white tusks in his slathering jaws. They hear the gnashing sound. They dash forward from both sides, but soon have to meet his terrible onset. So the Trojans dashed upon Odysseus. And Odysseus first leapt upon Deiopides and wounded his shoulder, then killed Thoon and Enemus, then stabbed Chersidamus under the shield upon the mid-nipple as he stepped out of his chariot. Down he fell in the dust and clutched the earth. These he left and wounded Charops Hippasides, own brother to Scocus. Then Scocus ran up to defend his brother and called out, "Odysseus, your name is great in the world, you glutton for tricks and fighting. This day either you shall boast that you have killed and stripped both sons of Hippasus, a great thing indeed, or my spear shall pierce you and rob you of life." Then he struck his shield. Right through the shield went the heavy spear, through the belt it forced its way, and tore all the skin from his flank. But Pallas Athenia would not let it run into his body. Odysseus knew it was no mortal wound, and stepped back, saying, "Fool, death has surely found you. It is true you have ended my fighting for the present, but you shall die here, I tell you, this very day, and my spear shall lay you low. You shall give victory to me and your soul to Hades." The other had already turned to retreat, but Odysseus drove his spear through the man's back, between his shoulders and out at the chest. He fell with a thud, and Odysseus cried out in triumph, "There, Socus Hippasides, death has been too quick for you, and you could not escape. Poor fool, your father and your mother shall not close your eyes in death. Carrion birds shall flap their wings about you and tear you to pieces. But when I die, my people will give me honorable funeral." He pulled the spear of Socus from his own body and out of the shield. The blood now ran and distressed him, and when the Trojans saw the blood of Odysseus flow, they called to each other and advanced all together. Odysseus began to retreat and call for help. Three times he shouted as loud as the man's head could hold. Three times Menelaus heard the shout. He said at once to Aeus beside him, "Aeus, Telamonian, my noble prince, the voice of Odysseus is ringing in my ears. It sounds as if they had cut him off alone, as if they were crushing him with numbers. Let us get there through this crowd. We ought to save him. I fear something may happen to him among the enemy alone. He is a fine fellow, and we should miss him greatly." So they made their way to Odysseus. They found the Trojans worrying him all round like a pack of grimy jackals round a wounded stag.
You have seen such a thing on the mountains. A huntsman has hit the stag with an arrow. The stag gets away and keeps a good pace as long as the blood is warm and his knees are nimble. But when the arrow is too much for him, the carrion jackals tear and crunch him under the trees. Then chance brings up a ravening lion. Away go the jackals, and the lion gorges himself. So the Trojans were worrying Odysseus, strong men, and many of them, while the warrior lunged out with his spear and kept them off. Then Aeus marched up with that great shield like a tower and stood by his side. Away went the Trojans, higgledy-piggledy. So Menelaus led him by the hand out of the crowd until the man came up with his chariot. But Aeus leapt on the Trojans and killed Doryclos, Priam's bastard son, wounded Pandacos, wounded Lysandros and Pyrrhasos and Pilates. The mighty man pressed them hard as he drove the whole field in rout, cutting down horses and men. He was like some mountain torrent in flood, which, driven by tempestuous rain, pours over the land, carrying many a dry oak tree and many a pine, until it casts a mass of flotsam into the sea. Hector had not yet heard of this, for he was fighting away on the left of the battle, near the banks of Scamandros. There most of all men's heads were beaten down, and uproar unquenchable was rising about Nestor and Idomeneus. Hector was having his talk with these, making a great mess with his spear play and horsemanship, as he devastated the young men in troops. Yet the Achaeans would never have given way, but that Alexandros stopped the exploits of Machaon with a three-barbed arrow in the right shoulder. The Achaeans, highly excited, were very much afraid that he might be caught if the battle turned, and Idomeneus said, "Nestor Neleiades, my lord king, do get into your chariot and take Machaon away to the ships as quickly as you can. A surgeon is worth many men when it comes to cutting out an arrow or putting on soothing simples." Nestor did so at once. He got in, and the surgeon got in. Was he not the son of the great healer, Asclepius? And the horses galloped away, not sorry to go. But Cebriones saw where the Trojans were being driven back as he stood beside Hector in the chariot, and he said to him, "Hector, we too are having a nice talk with the Danians here on the fringe of the battle, but the others are being driven pell-mell, horses and men. Telamonian Aeus is routing them. I know him well by the broad shield on his shoulders. Let us go there ourselves, where all that furious fighting is going on, and that terrific uproar." He touched up the horses, and when they heard the whistle of the whip, they sped away among Trojans and Achaeans, trampling on shields and dead bodies until the axle under them was soaked in blood, and the handrails were sprinkled with showers of drops from the horses' hooves and the wheels. Hector longed to get into the throng of men and to break it up. A terrible tumult he brought with him, and little spared his spear. With spear and sword and great stones he was everywhere, except that he kept clear of Aeus, Telamoniades. But Father Zeus now made Aeus think of retreat. He stood still dazed and shifted his great shield to his back. Then he retreated slowly and watchfully, step by step, towards his friends, looking round again and again like a wild animal. So the lion retreats from the cattle pen, driven away by dogs and farm hands, who keep awake all night long to save their fat cattle from his jaws. Greedy for meat, he goes straight on, but he gets none, for showers of javelins meet him, thrown by strong arms and burning faggots, which frighten the bravest beast. Then in the morning he leaves the place in gloomy mood. And Aeus was gloomy enough as he retreated before the enemy, much against his will, since he feared greatly for the Achaean ships. You have seen a stubborn ass in a cornfield, who is too much for the boys. They may break many sticks on his back, but he goes on cropping the corn. They beat away with their sticks, but what is the strength of a child? They can hardly drive him out when he has eaten all he wants. So the crowds of Trojans hung upon the heels of mighty Aeus, poking his shield with their poles all the time. Every now and then he would wheel about and drive off his assailants, then he turned and went on. But all the while he stood alone between the two armies, beating back the Trojans and barring the way to the ships. His great shield was struck full of spears that strong hands had thrown, and many more stuck in the ground between, still greedy for a taste of flesh. Retreating thus amid showers of missiles, Eurypylus saw him and came to his side, and with a cast of his spear he brought down Apisaon Phorcyades. The blow pierced the liver and killed him. Eurypylus began to strip off his armor, but this caught the eyes of Alexandros, who let fly at once. The arrow pierced his right thigh, and the shaft broke. Dragging his heavy leg, Eurypylus hobbled away, shrieking out, "My friends! My lords and princes! Face about and stand! Here is Aeus fighting against heavy odds. He will be shot to death. Stand and defend him! Rally round Aeus Telamoniades!" Then they formed round the wounded man, crouching on the right knee with their grounded shields resting against the left shoulder and their spears sloped forward at the ready. Aeus came towards them, and there he faced about and stood by their side. So they stood fast and fought like blazing fire. Meanwhile, Nestor's horses were sweating and steaming as they brought in Nestor and Machaon to the camp. Achilles was standing on the poop of his great ship and watching the lamentable rout. He saw the chariot come and noticed who it was, and shouted from the ship for Patroclus. In their hut, Patroclus heard the call and came out, a splendid figure. But for him this was the beginning of evil things. Patroclus said, "Why do you call me, Achilles? What do you want with me?" Achilles said, "Menetiades, friend of my heart, now I think I shall have the Achaeans at my knees. Dire necessity is upon them now. Make haste, my dear Patroclus, go and ask Nestor, who is this wounded man he is bringing out of the battle? His back looks just like Machaon Asclepiades, but I could not see the man's face. The horses were going too fast." Patroclus at once went off at a run into the camp. By this time the party had reached Nestor's hut. They got out. Eurymedon took out the horses, and the two men stood on the beach to dry the sweat off their garments in the sea breeze. Then they went in and sat down, and Hecamede set about making them a posset. She was a woman from Tenedos, the daughter of Arsinoos. When Achilles sacked the place, she had been chosen as a special prize for old Nestor, in honor of his wisdom and good advice at all times. Hecamede set before the two men a fine polished table with feet of blue enamel, and put on it a bronze basket with an onion as a relish for the drink, and pale honey, and ground barley meal. Beside them she placed a splendid goblet which the ancient man had brought from home, studded with golden knobs. It had four ears, and each ear had a pair of golden doves pecking their food, one on either side. Under it were two supports. Another man would hardly move it from the table when it was full, but old Nestor could lift it easily. In this goblet the woman mixed them a posset with Pramian wine, grating in goat's cheese with a grater of bronze, and sprinkled over it white barley meal. Then she invited them to drink of her posset, so they drank and slaked their parching thirst. While they were talking together comfortably, Patroclus appeared at the door. The ancient man sprang up from his chair and led him in and bade him be seated, but Patroclus declined. "No sitting for me, my lord, I can't think of it. Formidable, hot-tempered is he that sent me, to ask who the wounded man was that you were bringing in. But I know him myself, I see it is his honour, Machaon. Now I will go back and tell Achilles. You know well enough, reverend sir, what he is like, a terrible man. He might easily find fault where there is none."
Nestor answered, "Indeed, why is Achilles crying about a wounded man? Doesn't he know the trouble that has come upon the whole army? The best men are lying here in camp, wounded and stricken. Diomedes Tydides is shot, Odysseus has a spear thrust, and so has Agamemnon, and here is this man I have just brought from the field, shot with an arrow from the bowstring. But Achilles, brave man, cares nothing and pities none. Is he waiting until all the ships along the shore are well warmed by a general conflagration, and we ourselves are killed in a row? Ah, my strength is not what it was when my limbs were supple. If I were only young and strong now, as I was when that quarrel came up between Elis and our people over cattle-lifting, when I killed that brave man, Itamoneus, Hippyrochus' son, who lived in Elis. I was driving away our reprisals, he was defending his flocks from seizure, and I struck him with my spear. Down he fell, and all the clowns ran away in terror. We collected a world of spoil from that countryside, 50 herds of cattle, as many flocks of sheep, as many droves of swine, as many solid flocks of goats, Bayards, 150, all mares, many with foals at foot. All these we drove through the night to Pylos. and Neleus was a glad man that I had taken a great prize, when I went as a green hand into battle. Criers went out in the morning to noise abroad that all those who had a claim on Ela should come in. The leading men of our people assembled and did the dividing, for we Pylians were few in number and much aggrieved, and many of us had claims on the Epeans. You see, Heracles had come in former years and done a great deal of damage when our best men were killed. For Neleus had 12 sons, and all perished but me alone. So the Epeans got above themselves and did us mischief in their impudence. The old king chose out carefully a herd of cattle and a large flock of sheep, 300 with the drovers, for a great debt was owing to him in Elis, a chariot and 4 horses, prize winners, which had been sent there to the games. They were to run for a tripod. These Augeas the king held fast, but he let the driver go and mourn for his horses. So the old man took his revenge for their deeds and their words, and chose a mort of stuff himself, but left the rest to be divided up, that everyone might have his rights. So we arranged the business and held our sacrifices all over the city. But 3 days later, the Epeans came in full force, men and horses. With them came the 2 Molaians, armed like the rest, though they were only boys and knew nothing of battle. There is a city called Sedgetown on a steep hill, far away on the Alpheus, right at the end of sandy Pylos. They set their camp all round this place, intending to raze it to the ground. But when they had scoured the plain, Athena came running from Olympus in the night with the news, telling us to arm, assembling the people all over Pylos, and they were glad to come, eager for battle. Neleus forbade me to join them and hid my horses. He said, I knew nothing yet of regular war. But that was no matter. I went on foot, and yet I was to be seen among our horsemen by providence of Athena. There is a river, Menaeus, that empties into the sea not far from Arene. There we horsemen waited for dawn, while the companies of footmen came pouring up. From that place our army, in full force, came at midday to the river Alpheus. There we sacrificed victims to Zeus Almighty, a bull to Poseidon, a heifer of the herd to Bright-Eyes Athena. We took our meal in messes and slept under arms beside the river. The Epeans, meanwhile, were all round the city which they meant to destroy. But the god of war came first in his might, for when the sun rose bright above the earth, we joined battle with them, calling upon Zeus and Athena. I was the first to bring down my man Mulius, the spearman, and I took his horses. He was husband of Augeas' eldest daughter, Agamede, a woman who knew all the drugs and simples in the wide world. He drove at me. I struck with my spear. He fell in the dust, and I leapt into his car and took my stand in the front. The Epeans scattered higgledy-piggledy when they saw the leader and chief of their horsemen fall. I swept on them like a thunderstorm and took 50 chariots. 2 fellows tumbled out of each, right and left, by the thrusts of my conquering spear, and bit the dust. Then I should have destroyed Actor's sons, the Molians, themselves. But their father, the mighty Earthshaker, carried them out of the battle in a cloud and saved their lives. Then Zeus gave signal victory to the Pylians. We chased them over the wide plain, slaying and spoiling, until we drove our horses to the wheat fields of Buprasium and the Olenian rock, and to the hill of Elysian, where Athena made us turn. There I slew the last man, and left him. The army drove back to Peleus from Buprasium, and all gave thanks to Zeus among the host of heaven, and to Nestor among men. Such was I, a man with men, as truly as I live. But the valor of Achilles will profit Achilles alone. Profit? No, repentance will be his lot when our people are all destroyed. And you, laggard, what did Menoetius say to you when he sent you from Thyre to Agamemnon? We were there in the house, I and Odysseus, and heard all he said. We had been gathering recruits over the whole country, and we came to the palace of King Peleus. There we found Menoetius and you also, and Achilles was with you. The old king was making sacrifice to Zeus Thunderer in the courtyard. He held a golden cup and poured wine over the burnt offerings.
You two were busy with the meat, and there we were in the doorway. Achilles sprang up, excited, and led us in, bade us be seated, and gave us the guests' due honors. When we had eaten and drunk, I began by inviting you to come with us. You were both ready and willing, and the others laid many injunctions upon you. Peleus told his son to be first and foremost in the field, and this is what Panaetius said to you. My son, Achilles is above you in rank, and he is stronger than you, but you are the elder. You must give him good advice and tell him what to do. He will obey you for his own good. That was your father's bidding, and you have forgotten it. Yet even now, you should remind Achilles of this and see if he will listen. Who knows whether you may have the good luck to move him by your persuasions? The persuasion of a friend is a blessing in the end. If there is some oracle from Zeus he is shy of, something his gracious mother has told him, well then let him send you out with the Myrmidons, and you may show us light in the darkness. Let him lend you his armor to wear, and then the Trojans may take you for him. They may leave us alone to have a breathing space from the battle. Hardly time to take your breath in the face of sudden death. But your men are all fresh, and they could easily beat a weary enemy back to their city. This touched the heart of Patroclus, and he set off at a run. But as he was passing the ships of Odysseus, close to the place of public meeting at the altars, he met Eurypylus, limping out of the battle with the arrow in his thigh. Sweat poured over head and shoulders, and the blood still ran from his cruel wound, but he was undaunted. Patroclus was very sorry to see this, and he spoke out his feelings plainly. "Oh, you poor captains and princes! So you were to die far from home, your white fat to be gorged by the dogs of Troy. But my dear man Eurypylus, tell me, will they keep off this fiend Hector, or will he make an end of us all?" The wounded man answered, "Nothing can save us now, Patroclus. They will soon be upon our ships. All our best men are laid up here already, some shot with arrows, some stabbed with spears. The enemy grows stronger and stronger. But you can save my life. Just help me to my ship and cut out this arrow, wash the blood off with warm water, put on a soothing plaster, that good stuff you learnt about from Achilles, which he got from Chiron, the centaur, bless him. He was a gentleman. You know, our surgeons, Podalirius and Machaon, one is in camp, I think, wounded, and wants a good surgeon himself. The other is on the battlefield." Patroclus said, "What will come of it? What are we to do, my dear man? I am in a hurry to give Achilles a message from Geranian Nestor, but I can't help that. I will not desert you in this dreadful state." He put his arm around Eurypylus and led him to his quarters. His men saw them coming and made a bed of hides on the ground. There Patroclus laid the wounded man. He cut out the arrow and washed the place with warm water, and crumbled a bitter root between his fingers, letting the shreds drop into the wound. This was a bitter root which cures all pain, and it took away all his pain. The blood was staunched, and the wound dried. Book 12. How the two armies fought before the wall, and how Hector broke down the gate. While Patroclus was looking after the wounded man, a massed fight was going on outside, and it seemed that the moat was not to keep out the Trojans. That moat with the wall above it, which the Danaans had made to protect themselves and their ships, but forgot the sacrifices which were due to the gods. The gods did not consent to the building, and therefore it did not stand long. While Hector lived and Achilles nursed his anger and the city of Priam was unsacked, so long that great wall stood. But when the best men of Troy were killed with many of the Achaeans, and those who were left sacked the city of Priam in the 10th year, and the Achaeans had sailed away, then Poseidon and Apollo determined to smother the wall. All the rivers which flow down from Ida to the sea, Rhesus and Heptapyros, Carisos and Rhodios, Grinicos and Asipos, Scamandros and Simois, where shields and helmets had fallen in heaps, and the bodies of brave men, all these rivers they led upon it, turning their streams together. For 9 days the flood poured over the wall, and torrents of rain fell unceasing, that the sea might sooner swallow it up. Earthshaker himself guided the waters with his trident, until he had swept away all the foundations of logs and stones which the Achaeans had laid with such labor. Then he made smooth the shore of the Hellespont, and covered it over with sand again. When he had smothered the wall, he turned back the rivers into the courses where they had run before. But that was to come in the future. For the time being, war and uproar blazed about the strong-built wall, and spears rattled against the stones. The Argives, driven by the whip of Zeus, were cooped up among their ships for fear of Hector, that great master of panic, and he fought on and on like a furious tempest. You have seen a lion or a wild boar in a crowd of dogs and huntsmen turning to bay in desperate fury, while they stand like a long wall